Sportsnet 650, Vancouver.
Welcome back to Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd, Thomas Drantz here. We are live from the Kintech Studio. 650. 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Metro Vancouver's trusted choice for contractors and rental warriors for over 50 years. Visit them at one of their three locations to serve you or online at DunbarLumber.com. This hour of Canucks Talk brought to you by Rack Steel. Rack Steel offers industry-leading heli forklifts and engineered racking solutions. Visit them online at racksteel.com. Kevin Woodley is going to join us at 1 today on the show. But we got an open segment here, so we can dive into the inbox a little bit. Andy the Park Ranger texts in, "My main hope for this deadline, as Drantz said, is some creativity. Sell on expiring to buy youth and upside, or being the broker in the middle of a three-way trade. I want to see a shuffle, not an all-in buy at the expense of value heading out the door." And I think what most people would agree on, and my sense is that Canucks management is well aware of this as well, is the one absolute no-go is acting like a traditional buyer at the deadline. Right. And I mean an aggressive buyer, a buyer like we saw them be last year. That wasn't at the deadline, but they give up, obviously, the first round pick, a decent prospect as well, going the other way to the Calgary Flames for Elias Lindholm. I think we all understand that's out. That is an absolute no go. And I would be very, very surprised if we saw anything along those lines this time around at the deadline, considering where the Canucks are, considering how desperately they need those future assets and all of that. That would be very, very shocking. Anything beyond that, though, as I was saying, Satyar Shah reported on Halford and Brough this morning, does feel like it's going to be on the table. And, you know, one thing that Sat pointed out that I think is good to keep in mind, if there's anything that any kind of competitive advantage the Canucks have over other teams on the market going into the trade deadline, it could be their salary cap space, right? And that opens up some interesting potential things for them to do. And Sat noted last year, I believe it was Nashville, was able to acquire Jason Zucker for like a seventh round pick just because they were able to take on his whole salary. Now, that was from Arizona, and Arizona's always weirdly motivated to, or was always weirdly motivated when they were in the league, to get money off their books and everything. But if you're wondering, because my appetite even for the, well, trade Besser and then use some of those assets to bring in a cheaper replacement, like my appetite for that has been dwindling over the course of the road trip, seeing how they've performed. But if it is a case where you're getting just a huge discount because of your ability to make it work salary cap wise, or you absorb some other salary from a team that they're just trying to get off their books, and it's almost not free, but like pretty close to being free, all right, I'm interested in that. Like, that to me is a way to not have your cake and eat it too, but at least like have the illusion of having your cake and eating it too, right? Saying, hey, see, we're not waving the white flag. We brought in this guy. Use that cap space, that cap flexibility to get a little bit creative.
Yeah, I mean, what I would like to see, I think, you know, overall, like, I do think there's an interesting opportunity to potentially find some long-term fits. You know what I mean? Like, yes. to do some Hronek style deals.
And I have no issue with that. Like, for me, the number one thing I want to see if you're buying is long-term fit.
Right.
Now, I guess that can be a UFA if you're then very aggressive about getting them done to a deal. They did it with Marcus Pedersen, Drew O'Connor. That comes with some risks of its own. But I mean, I think we've also seen teams like Vegas has done a bunch of long-term focused deals at the deadline over the last few years, right? You know what I mean? It is a strategy that can work while other teams are focused on rentals. So I don't have as much of an issue with that. I think that, like, if you're going to buy, those are the candidates, those are the targets you have to be zeroing in on more than anything else.
Yeah. You know, even like the guy that always stands out to me in this type of conversation is Jake Evans, mm-hmm. right? Who's 28. He'll be 29 at the start of his next contract. You're probably looking at a 4x4.5, maybe 4x5 valuation, which is pretty pricey. But he's a UFA right-handed center. He's got wheels, which, man, I thought that was one of the most noticeable parts of this trip. I thought with Filip Hedl on the ice, this Canucks team looks one way. And in Pettersson State, Pugh Suter, who I like at center enough, but I think he's high end on the wing, and I think it's a little bit different for him at center.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't bring that speed element.
No.
And then Bluger obviously doesn't. And as a result, I thought you could see it as those games went on. Like Jack Eichel's speed was a big problem for Vancouver against Vegas. And then Clayton Keller and Barrett Hayton's speed was a big problem for Vancouver against Utah. And then Quinton Byfield flipped the switch in that LA game that they won. At center, Troy Terry gave them nightmares, you know, both off the rush and just carrying the puck through the neutral zone. Like, that speed was hard to deal with. And then Shane Wright, I thought, was maybe the most impactful forward in the first 40 minutes of that game against Seattle, partly because his speed, which also helped Seattle score the first goal, gave the Canucks fits. Like, they, every night it's a mismatch for the Canucks in terms of the wheels that they have in the middle of the ice.
And it's extremely noticeable.
Extremely noticeable. Like,
extremely noticeable.
So, you know, you get a right-handed center. He's sort of in the right age range for the next 2-3 years. Like, to me, that's the sort of thing where if you do end up having to deal Brock Besser, right? You get some assets, you turn around, you flip some of those assets for Jake Evans. Like, on the PDO cast, we did our fake trades thing, and my sort of fake trades Canucks two-step was Besser to Tampa Bay, because I want Tampa Bay to add a right-handed shot on the power play. And the Canucks would get something like a second and Isaac Howard, who's like a point per game plus former first round pick with Michigan. So you don't get the first round pick because they don't have one.
But you get the former first round pick.
But you get the former first round pick, who's also like going to probably play NHL games for you this year and is something of a dog in terms of his work rate with high end speed.
He's the guy who had the great suit on his draft day.
Right? Yeah, he did. He had the big American flag suit.
Yeah.
Very sick. So I guess you'd have to make sure that he's comfortable signing in Canada, given his college
due diligence. Yeah,
but you know that's something that the Canucks are well positioned to figure out with Scott Young and company. And then turn around and send the second you get, plus your own second even, to Montreal, get Jake Evans, sign him. To me, that's the sort of thing, especially because I think it's easier to figure out the wings.
Like, well, yes, 100%.
If the logic of this Canucks team is going to require Pettersson to bounce back anyway, I actually think this 5-game road trip was the worst we've seen of him. And we can get into that more in the last segment. I don't want to pile on, so it's like...
No, I don't want to pile on, but you also have to... Like, you can't...
This hit a level of concern for me beyond where
we've been. We can't just ignore it either. You know what I mean? And look, I was on the show. I did the show by myself on Friday, and I think we're on pretty similar wavelengths here, right? Now, that was before the Kraken game even, but what I was pointing out on Friday was, you know, you go back, not just this 5-game road trip, but you go back to like December, kind of early to mid-December. From that point, he's been one of the least productive players considering his minutes in the NHL.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's gone from, well, he's not living up to his contract, to fringe NHL type of play from Elias Pettersson. And what, like, it's somehow gotten worse. That's the thing that has really struck me. And I don't know if it's rock bottom. I thought the San Jose game before the Four Nations was rock bottom. So I don't want to say like this is rock bottom, but it's a new low point for sure. What happened over these 5 games for Elias Pettersson?
It's just the way that the two-way game is cratered. You know, like at least the defensive play was kind of there. If you wanted to squint and make the little things argument, I mean, obviously you were deluded to be doing so, but 18 shots for, 39 against, 21. That's an average of being outshot. And this is just 5-on-5.
Yeah.
That's an average of being outshot by 5 every game across this road trip. Outscored 5-1 and out attempted by a ratio of nearly 2-1. 82 shot attempts against, 47 shot attempts for. That's like you can't find the offensive zone with a map territory.
No.
It, like, if that was a fourth liner, I'd be using a word like unplayable.
Yeah, if you called a guy up, and obviously it wouldn't happen over 5 games to get the minute sample that long, but like over 2 weeks.
Yeah,
you'd be like, this guy's not ready.
No, this is not ready
to help us win.
This isn't working, and we'd be saying that at the bottom of the lineup. When it's happening at the top of the lineup, because Pettersson also played the second most minutes.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what What can you do? You know, and by the way, this is another reason why I think the Canucks have to be looking at themselves sternly and honestly in the mirror, while also not reacting emotionally to a 1-4 road trip in sort of charting their next step forward here, right? If Pettersson's going to play like this, if there's no light at the end of that tunnel this season, and I'm sure that's not how they're viewing it, but I think it's something you at least have to consider as a realistic possibility.
How could you, like, even if you're holding out hope that over the next 20 games he figures it out, I mean, how you can cross your fingers and hope, but you also have to be planning for what, from all appearances, looks like the overwhelmingly more likely option that it's just this for at least these next 20 games. Like, that has to be how you are planning. Because what one thing can you point to and say, oh, no, don't worry, he's going to figure it out because of X. There's nothing right now.
If Lankanen's running out of gas, and you're going to need at least 10, maybe 15 starts from another goaltender, do you trust that Demko's body holds up for that? Do you trust that Silovs can play at a good enough level to get you through? Because every point's going to matter. You're going to need to get to the low 90s. You're going to need to get to 93, 94. One of these teams is going to get super hot. It's going to be Utah. So, do you feel good about that bet? And then the Hughes factor, right? I mean, can you ride him 28 minutes a night and get a lead impact given what he's been through over the course of the past month and where he's at? Like, can he... Is asking him to hold up the world Atlas style just simply asking too much of him right now? I mean, I don't know, man. Across the board, don't you check those off? Like, am I even being negative to be like, I shade toward the pessimistic side on all three questions? Is that even negative?
I don't think it's out of step with how the market is feeling right now.
I don't think it's out of step with reality. Like, it's I don't even think it's a feeling thing. It's just like... What were we talking about? I got so worked up with my checklist.
We were talking about Pettersson, but then I don't
know. Oh, no, buying.
Yeah, right.
This team now, I think we all kind of like where their blue line's shaped up to.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, even if you quibble with the cost paid, which I think is reasonable, you can look at this and say, okay, like, there's actual options left and right side. In fact, they should probably be considering subtracting from there. Right, you can probably deal Forbert for a mid-rounder or Carson Soucy to free up the cap space.
Yeah,
like, because you have enough bodies.
Forbert feels like the all-time slam dunk of slam dunks.
Well, unless you're doing Soucy.
Unless you're doing Soucy, I guess, but still.
Unless you're doing Soucy and using the fact that Forbert has, like, not played that much. Because I like Forbert's game.
There's no problem with having him on your bottom pair. Zero problem.
No, if he's your seven next year, you are laughing.
Yeah.
He is a good professional defensive defenseman. Period. So that would be. But dealing one of those guys feels like a tap in, frankly, given sort of where they're at and the fact that Valander's coming and the fact that you probably want to see Mancini more. At least I do. And then you sort of get to the Suter question, the Besser question, and. You know, I do think if you're able to sell and if you're able to find a buying opportunity, especially at center over the course of the next week, even if it's a little pricey, but the fit is right, I think that's worth doing. Like, I really do. I will not be criticizing this management group if they buy a long-term fit over the course of the next week.
Yeah, assuming the price is right and fit and all that, right? But yeah, you got to do it at some point.
Forget the price. If the fit is right, I think that makes sense.
They
need some speed at center in the worst possible way.
They really do. They need, I mean, your favorite word, juice. They need the juice up front in a big, big way.
Oh, yeah.
They are juiceless right now.
It's hard to concentrate. They're so juiceless.
That's absolutely.
What?
This is just so bad.
Too pulpy for you?
So bad. Yeah. Something like that. This text comes in from three putt Shane character. That's what I'd like to see at the deadline. That's an interesting one for me because, I mean, we talked about the Braden Schenn thing last week or the week before with him rumored to be potentially on the market from St. Louis. I'm always wary of.
Sorry, which guys?
Braden Schenn. This texture says they like to see character added at the deadline.
I'm a big fan of Braden Schenn. I think that could make sense.
I'm always wary of prioritizing
character,
like character in its own thing, not prioritizing character in the guys you go after that are also good hockey fits. You know what I mean? But making moves strictly to bring in character Having said that,
no, Braden Shen
oh, no,
is for
no, no,
real.
No, but just separated from Braden Shen. Yeah. Just like in general being like, we need to go out and bring in a guy who we're mostly bringing in for his character.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's tough.
I'm always wary of that, but I also look at this team and the culture or glaring lack of culture that seems to have developed around it, and I get it. You know what I mean? Like, if we're talking about, if we're giving like serious credence to the idea that like losing Ian Cole is part of what cratered this season because he was such a good veteran in the room.
Well, I also think it's because he was a good player.
He was a good player,
yeah,
but
he still is.
I this is not in my normal wheelhouse where I'm like, yeah, they need to go out and get that veteran on the third pair who's like a great guy in the room or whatever. This team, I think I'm willing to make an exception for. And again, I don't know if you're paying deadline prices. That to me is maybe more of a summer thing. And yeah, you would love the hockey fit to be there and everything. And maybe Braden Shen makes sense for that reason. But I get watching this team right now and being like, man, can we go get somebody with some character to come in and help these guys?
Well, that's what actually kind of bugged me, because I really liked their performance in Seattle, but I was also on that road trip and I was like, why don't they play like this every night? You know, like, fundamentally, one of the reasons I think this team struggles to generate offense night to night is that I don't think they're working hard enough as a group. And maybe they think they do, but I don't think they are. They don't play with the level of sort of pace and intention that that implies to me that they're maintaining a high enough work rate to execute their system, to execute the way that they need to, given sort of the limitations of this roster, to win. And that was never something we saw from them last year.
And I thought really telling that Rick Tocchet put Elias Pettersson and Brock Besser together against the Seattle Kraken.
With Dakota Joshua.
With Dakota Joshua.
I referred to it in my gamer as a tactical retreat. Yes. I thought he put his three players that were struggling the most together, partly to challenge them, and partly because if they didn't figure it out, then at least they'd be isolated to one another, allowing him to have a better chance. But here's what happened, Jamie. Every other Canucks forward line outshot the opposition, except them.
And it wasn't like, it wasn't close for them.
No.
And I think it's very telling. And you hear Rick Tocchet talk about, hey, some of my top guys, and we all default to, you know, they need to shoot the puck, they need to do something, they need to get going. We all default to assuming he's talking about Elias Pettersson, and he is.
Yeah, he definitely is.
He is.
That is all about Elias Pettersson.
But it's also about Brock Besser right now.
Yeah, it is.
You know what I mean? And I think, again, you just look at him putting those guys together, and you're talking about the lack of effort. It starts right there. It starts right there with, okay, we're going to put the guys who should be our first and best forwards. Now that Besser is gone, now that Miller's gone, two best forwards, Pettersson and Besser, that should be like, hey, we're loading up a line with those two guys, and that gives us a chance to do something exciting, and instead it's easily your worst line. Easily your worst line against the Kraken.
So I think the one thing I want to read this text from JCast, the somehow still optimistic Canucks fan. He says, I'm remaining confident in Alvin and Jim Rutherford before the deadline. Rutherford warned us we were going to get worse before the JT trade went down. I'm excited to see what players and assets we're able to obtain, yet still hope there's a way to sneak into the playoffs. There's always lessons to be learned in a playoff game. I agree, by the way.
Sure.
I am absolutely not team wave the white flag. I'm just team, you have a certain finite number of assets to use, and you can't use them, nor can you incur the opportunity cost of not taking advantage of this deadline to look further ahead, which is not to say that you can't spend some, right, or be mindful of the present as well, because I do think that matters. I think it matters to Hughes. I think it matters to this team. I mean, Hughes is grinding to play games right now. I definitely don't think you can pull the shoot on a player who's giving you that, who's making those sorts of sacrifices to be part of this team and to try and lead you to the playoffs.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you owe that guy the respect of not waving the white flag, for sure. I am absolutely not suggesting otherwise. But I think where JCast makes a good point is we've been through so many disappointing deadlines where the Canucks' mistakes were telegraphed well in advance, where we could see it all coming, where we all knew it was stupid, and yet the club did an incredibly short-term thing anyway. I do think when you step back and look at sort of the breadth of work under Alvin and Rutherford, you know, you've seen them, like, they traded away rental players or own rental potential guys during the Bruce There It Is bump season.
Yep.
They didn't chase the playoffs that year. The next year, they were further out of it, but nonetheless, We saw them buy Hronek, but we also saw them sell Bo Horvat, right? Like, we did see them generally be mindful of it. We've only ever seen them trade their own first on one occasion, and it happened the year they were in first place in the league. They were literally the number one in the standings when they did it. Okay, that's pretty justifiable. Otherwise, they've made their own first at the very least, even if they hadn't or didn't go about accumulating draft capital the way I might like to see. They have been disciplined in terms of managing the cap. Like, for the most part, you can disagree with approach. You can disagree with the way that they invested and believed in this core, right? By no means have they been error-free in their judgment, okay? Including the treatment of Bruce Boudreau and on and on. But for the most part, they've at least been professional and competent. And I do think that, you know, for the don't get mad in advance file, we should at least weight that pretty heavily.
I think the counter argument, and I'm not saying this because I think this is what's going to happen.
I love a counter argument.
The counter argument is that they haven't been in this situation yet where it feels more like a legitimately hard decision. Because even in the Bruce, there it is, season one, I mean, they didn't believe in that team, right? Like, they didn't believe in what Bruce Boudreau was doing or the actual level of that team. Now, I'm not saying they believe in this team, but I think that does color it a little bit. You're still early in your tenure. Maybe it's a little bit easier to make some of those decisions. And the other big thing, of course, is none of the players they've moved, you know, the Bo Horvat one to me is different because it was like, we all saw the writing on the wall and they immediately flip it for Filip Hronek. None of the pending UFAs they've moved at the deadline are Brock Besser caliber players. So that's where the kind of rubber hits the road. It's easy to, hey, we're kind of in the playoff race, but yeah, we'll still trade Tyler Motte. Yeah, of course you will. Or we'll still trade Luke Shen. Luke Shen's a good player, but that's a lot different than trading Brock Besser. Now, I'm not saying, and therefore I think it's going to be different this time, but I think that's where a lot of the concern and the pre-anger that we're seeing and we're getting into our inbox right now is coming from, is that this does feel different, significantly different than some of those past situations that the team's found itself in and where they have traded the UFA guys going into the deadline. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Keep sending your texts in all week. And by the way, trade deadline coverage on Sportsnet 650 is brought to you by AJ's Pizza on East Broadway. For diehard pizza people, order online at AJ's.pizza. I also, of course, have to remind you, can't find the latest episodes of your favorite HGTV, Discovery, and Food Network shows? Rogers Xfinity TV has the newest seasons of the top-rated shows on these popular channels, while other providers are no longer including them in their TV lineup. If your TV provider doesn't carry these channels, you're missing out on new seasons of Celebrity IOU, Hometown, Beat Bobby Flay, Expedition X, and more. Don't be fooled by other channels pretending to be these networks you know and love. Get the latest with Rogers Xfinity TV at Rogers.com. Kevin Woodley on the other side here on Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650. Canucks Talk, you're on Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd, Thomas Drance. We're broadcasting live from the Kintec studio. Kintec Footwear and Orthotics working together with you in step. 650. 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Trade deadline coming up on Friday. Canucks back home after the road trip and joining us now to talk about all of that and more from NHL.com and Ingle Magazine. He's a presentation of White Rock Hyundai. He is Kevin Woodley. Woodley, how's it going, man?
It's good. It's good. Me and Durant traded spots in the road trip. He did all the hard work, and then I just bombed down to Seattle for a night. I took the easy out.
Yeah, Durant was he was hustling. He was had some tough travel days in there. So as you said, you got the better end of the deal on that one. So I mean, you were only in the building for the Seattle one, but just the totality of the 5-game road trip, only the one win, some really tough losses in there. What did you kind of think of the whole thing?
So, you know, I was talking on another show late last week about this. Like, I didn't mind the start of the trip. I thought they got goalied in Vegas, especially late. generated enough there, kind of like a lot of teams maybe struggled to find their footing out of the gate. Hey, true of Vegas too, right? Coming off the break. And I think there's an interesting trend here on the second half of back-to-backs. And I think it has to do, and I heard Thomas talking about this a little earlier and was talking with Harm about this yesterday, and I talked to a bunch of players about this, sort of at all the practices coming out of, you know, as the Four Nations was still going on and the Canucks were practicing but not playing games. And that's the work rate required to be effective with the way they play. And I don't think it's a coincidence. I don't think they've met that work rate consistently enough throughout this season. I think that's where you see a lot of the fall off. The way they play is hard to play. And so you get into situations where, you know, even though they lost in Vegas, I didn't mind it. And like I said, like, they did more than enough to win that game. Then you go the second half of back-to-back, and there's none of it's there. Like, all the underlying numbers that were there in Vegas disappear. And even L.A. to Anaheim, as much as L.A. wasn't pretty, was never going to be pretty, let's be honest, just because it's of the way the Kings play. And as offensively limited as these guys are, there's nothing there in the second half. And I think it speaks to a little bit just how, like, where the margins are for this team and how a lot of it is based in work rate. And again, after almost never questioning that work rate last season, there's been a lot of nights where, at least from top to bottom, start to finish, there are clear, you know, glaring absences of it, and it costs them.
I want to talk goaltending here. So, Shelovs has the solid performance in Anaheim, or sorry, in Utah, yep. Salt Lake, and then, I mean, I thought he was really poor against the Ducks. Did the numbers sort of back that up? I mean, it looked like at least two of those were not high danger, and maybe a third as well.
I think we had some mids, and only one of them were low. Like, there was
the one from the side was low.
Yeah, and you know, I mean, like, some of them like may not look great, but you know, the reality is there was some time and space elements to some of those chances against the Ducks that you know, they matter. So it was one low, one mid, and two high. But again, you know, on the amount of chances the Ducks generated, it was too many. And to me, the big thing was how different he looked as a goaltender from Utah. And I actually had an NHL goalie coach reach out about it as well, and kind of noticed the same things. Like, it's not just the results, it was the process and how different it looked from Utah to Anaheim. And the results sort of followed, and it left us with some questions about, you wonder if there's some changes that he's trying to make, and why did they seem to take hold in Utah and disappear in Anaheim? Maybe a function of the quality of chances. I mean, the open looks, the middle of the ice that they gave up in Anaheim that they didn't necessarily in Utah. Like, even the chances in the slot in Utah were largely off plays down low and cycle plays and pop passes versus rush, where teams are skating with time and space in the middle of the ice. You know, the 3-on-2 against Anaheim. And the difference is, when he gets low and wide in his stance, and then he starts, as soon as he does, he kind of loses his hands and starts turning on pucks rather than staying narrow, which allows him to sort of stay over top of releases, keep his hands, keep access to his hands in a more efficient manner, and move into pucks. And what I don't have the answer, because it's a small sample, is how much of that was the chance type in Utah didn't put him under pressure versus, you know, whether it's the pressure or the way it started or whatever. We tend to revert to old habits under pressure when things aren't going well, because it looked, not just from a result standpoint, but from a process standpoint, like two different goaltenders that stretches in that game. And you see when he gets too low and too wide in his stance, you see how the hands come back, and he, rather than closing down, everything pulls away, and there's just exposure there on open releases that didn't appear to be there in Utah. And so there's a lot of different reasons possible for this, like, which could include, we're now looking at three different voices in 2 years. Most of the year with Marco last year, comes up with Ian, starts with Marco this year, goes down with Justin Pogge. Now he's back up. Like, so there could be, you know, especially with the change overall with Clark no longer involved in the day to day, there may be an effort to sort of change some of those stance mechanics and trying to narrow him up a little more often. And, you know, maybe they held in the first game and got away from him in the second. All I know is that I wasn't the only one that saw it. Like I said, other people around the league were like, wow, like, not just did it not go well, but here's why it didn't go well. And it looked like two different guys. And so, I mean, you can look at the negative, and the negative is, you know, how comfortable are you playing him after the second one? That's the tough part of this. But the positive was, like, I liked his game in Utah. Like, I liked, and the question becomes, was it just there wasn't exposure that led to sort of that low and wide stance? Or was that just a sign of what's capable as he gets more and more comfortable holding on to it under more duress and for longer periods of time? And so I think we tend to forget a little bit, like, he is still somewhat early in the process. I know there's a big enough sample size now, but there's still evolution that can happen for a goaltender who, you know, again, getting back to the pandemic, lost a massive year of development and is still trying to make that up from a games played perspective compared to some of his peers.
If you're looking ahead to beyond this season with Archer Seelovs, I mean, you know, I think back a couple of years ago when Rick Tocchet emphasizing how many guys on his team needed to have a big summer. You talk about, you know, development that can still happen with him. How, like, for a goalie, how much of that can happen in the summer between the end of the season and training camp? Is there a chance we're looking at, you know, Archer Seelovs coming into training camp and really having tightened up a lot of those details? Or is this the sort of thing that really has to happen with game reps either at the AHL or NHL level?
Well, I can't fully answer because the hard part about everything I just said is I haven't had a really chance to talk to him about
sure.
And see how much of this is, because of course he was up here at the start of the season, but he went down and worked with Justin Pogge, and I don't know, we talked a little bit loosely about some of the changes he's trying to make, but we didn't get into details. So if this is something where there is an evolution taking place here, then for sure a summer can make a big difference. But part of the thing that, you know, he needs to figure out at this level, and we've talked about it before, like the traffic, and that's going to take reps at this level because it's not the same in the American League, and that becomes part of the challenge. You got to have enough confidence to play the guy so he can get the experience to get comfortable with those things. And so you look at Utah as a good example, and then obviously not so good in Anaheim. Massive changes? I don't know. I don't want to. Is it possible? Yes. I think you just get another year more comfortable. To me, most of the stuff starts in season. If he's comfortable with it, believes in it, and he can take it into the offseason and work on it, then yeah, absolutely. You can continue to progress. We see late bloomers in goaltending all the time. And the thing is, what we can't forget is for all the focus on the areas that he's continuing to try and work on, there's still some elite skill that was on display in both games, down low and in tight. Like, there are still things that he does that you can't teach that are at an exceptional level, that give him a base on certain types of plays that not every goalie has. And then you add to that the fact that, you know, the way he's handled, whether it's the World Championships or the playoffs, and I don't think the moments necessarily get too big for him. That's why I was a little surprised to see sort of such a different foundation in his game in Anaheim, and don't honestly have the answer as to why it looks so different, but you trust that he can handle things mentally. Like, there's still a lot of boxes that get checked on the positive side, and yet it feels like, you know, certainly within this organization, it's fair to wonder how many more chances he'll get to check them at the NHL level.
Kevin Lankinen has tied his NHL career high for appearances in a season now at 37. Still 22 games left on the schedule for the Canucks, obviously in the thick of a playoff race. Uncertainty around Thatcher Demko's status right now, you know, uncertainty around how much you can rely on Archer Seelovs. How concerned are you as, you know, that we kind of break new ground here in terms of how many games Kevin Lankinen has played in a season, about him holding up to the workload down the stretch?
Well, I mean, there's a couple of things that would worry you a little bit. I mean, so he was obviously really good right out of the gate in that Vegas game, but Like, I don't know if Thomas, you've probably done the same and talked to guys around the league with different teams about just how worn out the guys coming back from Four Nations have been.
Mm-hmm.
And the toll it's taken. Like in Vegas, they were giving Aiden Hill didn't play in the Four Nations and they were giving him practice days off to try and reset him. Like complete practice days off, like using the practice goalie
it's
to
like,
give him rest.
It's like the guys were on an extra 2 week road trip. Like if you're a Canucks player, it's like 2 weeks into your road trip, you began a 2 week road trip.
And
you
just
know,
as a quick aside away from goaltending here, the sample goes much further than Four Nations and the criticism. I'm not trying to bail him out on it, but Pettersson's a part of this conversation as well, right? Like, I don't think anybody, it feels like nobody's given him any grace right now. And I'm not asking people to, but it is something to file away in the back of your head. Like I've talked to people on other teams, parts of coaching staffs about the guys coming back who aren't in the same focus and aren't in the same spotlight. And they're just, they have nothing. Like we saw McDavid kind of cop to it, right? Like it's really hard to get up for this. But like other guys that aren't in the same, you know, bright, shining spotlight are like, it's just been really hard to come back from this. And so you add that to Lankinen's workload never being in this territory before, to the fact that, you know, the only reason his underlying numbers aren't better than they are right now is because when the starts have piled up, there's been a dip in performance that has cost his sort of statistical profile. You think of the Edmonton game, you think of the Winnipeg game, and not coincidentally, they both come at the end of stretches where it's not about the games played total. It's about say 5-6 or 6-8. And that's where you start to get into a little bit of concern because he just hasn't done it at this level in a long time. You know, obviously the Chicago year was the only year he was even close. So, I think the pause is, I don't expect Thatcher Demko to be out for long. I know Thatcher or Rick said to us yesterday that he's already skating. My impression is that he's probably not going to be too far away. And that bodes well, because obviously they're going to need great goaltending down the stretch. And your best chance would be to get both of these guys going. And I think, you know, if there's any chance of Thatcher at all picking up where he left off, that allows you to make sure you can also get the best out of Kevin Lankinen, but not running him out there for 6 out of 7.
When we look ahead to the deadline, I've sort of been bringing up three factors, Kevin. One is Quinn Hughes, right? He played when this team was winning games earlier this year. Hughes was like regularly at 28, 29 minutes in the games that they needed him to be. You know, he's missed a month of hockey. He's came back for two games. He couldn't play the third period. It's clear that he's dealing with a multitude of injuries, the hand, the oblique. And now a comp injury related to that. I mean, how much can you count on Quinn Hughes being the best version of himself? We know what Elias Pettersson is. I'd say that last 5-game road trip was perhaps the most concerning 5 games we've seen from him, which is saying a lot given what we've seen over the past 12 months. And then
with the caveat that I just gave you about how guys have reacted coming out of the break. But yes, I agree.
And then you get to this goaltending situation where, and this would be how I'd sort of recap it, and I just want to get your thoughts on it and let me know if you disagree, which is Lankinen's approaching his career high in games played, and I think there are signs of overuse in terms of his performance. Shelov's, the Canucks have won 1 of the 7 games he started this year, and Demko, I have no idea what you're going to get out of him. So, you know, can you reliably count on getting average or better goaltending down the stretch? What's your take on that third factor that I'm sort of looking at when I'm assessing sort of what this team's outlook is here at this sort of pivot point in the season?
Well, the Demko part is it's a two-parter, right? Like it's and the first part they'll have a better idea of than we do in terms of when they expect him to be back. Does he rejoin the team in practice this week? Is he possible to play, you know, towards the end of this 7-8 or even sooner on this? And we just don't know. But then the second part is, did he get enough traction in that 5-game stretch before this latest injury to sort of rediscover it? Like, he found his game. That much was evident. Like, that was peak of powers or as close to it as we've seen this year, Thatcher Demko. it was elite. It was fun to watch. There were some really great moments in there, and it was a reminder of what this guy is capable of, you know, being one of the best goaltenders in the NHL. There's been so many fits and starts to his season. And I think in the past, like, I was guilty of this, of thinking, like, he typically comes back and the runway for him has been shorter to get back up to speed. And it hasn't been the case this year. And of course it wouldn't be, because he missed so much time and so much crucial time and development time and the regular things he does with all his different coaches to get ready. So of course that was going to be the case, but through the, whether it's the back end, like, it's, he's never been able to get that traction. So the part I can't answer, and I don't know if they can either, is when he comes back, what does it look like and how long does it take to look like the guy we watched in the previous five games? Because the sooner you get back to that guy, the sooner you have confidence in this team having a chance to at least make the playoffs. Because, again, it gives you both of them at better levels because you're not overtaxing Kevin Lankinen. I think the answer to the first part is sooner rather than later, but I'm not sure anybody knows for sure the answer to the second part. My hunch is, because of how good he looked in those five games, and he was finally leading with vision, he wasn't going body first in a lot of movements, and it looks so much like what we're used to seeing when he's at his best, that having sort of discovered that form for the first time this season and hanging on to it for a steady stretch, it will be not easy, but easier to find that again coming back. And that's your best case scenario for the Canucks, because then you don't have to play Kevin Lankinen too much. And now you've got, an advantage at the position over most teams, in the division, in the conference, right? Because now you've got two elite guys. And frankly, you get elite Thatcher back. Now you don't have to overplay Kevin, and you get him at an even better level. What he's been for most of this season, that's probably your biggest upside. But as you point out, there's questions about whether it happens or not still.
Woodley, great stuff as always, man. Always appreciate it. Thank you for doing this. We'll chat soon.
Thanks, guys.
That is Kevin Woodley on Sportsnet 650, brought to you by White Rock Hyundai. Visit the showroom on King George in White Rock or whiterockhyundai.com. And you look ahead at the schedule, and obviously they've got this little mini 3-day break here before they play Anaheim on Wednesday. But then the remainder of the March schedule is very condensed. I think they only have one other extra day off, like a two-day break between games in March, and that's in the middle of a couple of back-to-backs. So you've got back-to-backs. You've got basically, other than that, every other day consistently here for the remainder of March. So you're going to need two goalies. And there's no, for this team going all out trying to make the playoffs, there's no, like, punting on games. And if you don't think you can put Artur Shelov's in, you are going to have two goalies and ideally playing at a high level to manage the schedule here for the rest of March. It's a big deal. I mean, we'll see tomorrow when they hit the ice on practice. Obviously, a lot of focus will be on Quinn Hughes. But when does Thatcher Demko start skating with the team, and when he's good to go is going to be a big deal as well, because they've got a back-to-back Tuesday and Wednesday next week, and then Saturday and Sunday that weekend. So they've got, like, imminent back-to-back games here where they're going to have to manage.
Yeah, I mean, I think you need one of these outs to pay off, okay? Like, that's really why I'm building this list of three. You need, I mean, you need realistically at least one, and let's say one and a half.
Mm-hmm.
You need Pettersson to at least play like a second-line caliber player, which he hasn't done in a long time.
I would say, I think you could make the argument, and again, this is a little bit of ground I covered on Friday, but until, like, December 10th, I think he had 26 points in 28 games. And that's not, he was a point per game. He was doing great. He wasn't. We could all see he wasn't having the impact on a night-to-night basis that he needed to. But it's like second line level. You know what I mean? It's like a second line guy piling up points. Since then, he's been off the map. He's been, like, almost just zero impact night-to-night for this team. And as you're saying, I don't think anyone's holding out hope that we get peak Elias Pettersson, certainly in the remainder of this season. Can you just not be a fourth line guy? Can you not be a fringe NHL guy? Can you do, as you said, at least get back to that, like, quasi, you know, if you squint, second line center level that maybe we saw earlier in the season? But even that, who knows? But anyways, go ahead.
So that's one. You need Quinn Hughes to come back, and I think you need him to be dominant. I don't think it's enough for him to be at the level of, like, a Makar or Haskinen. You need him to be at the level of Quinn Hughes.
Yeah. Yeah, you need him to be MVP caliber Quinn Hughes.
I love saying Makar and Heiskanen dismissively. They're so good. It's just what we're saying, what we saw. It's important to reflect on just what we saw from Quinn Hughes over the last like 120 games of his NHL career, right? It was just so transcendent. And they need that guy. And then Demko gets to the level that he was right before the latest injury, right? Like those three games that he was playing right after the JT Miller trade where he was usual dominant Demko. Like if you get one and a half of those things.
Yeah. So
I
to
think
me,
you outlast Utah.
The most realistic of those is number one, Quinn Hughes. Not that you get him back on Wednesday.
I'm worried about all of them.
That's fair. It's completely fair. But if we're just like power ranking by what you think is going to happen.
Yeah.
Number one is Quinn Hughes.
Yeah.
Because how could you bet on any of the other guys over Quinn Hughes? You can't.
Correct. You can't. No.
So number one is Quinn Hughes. Number two is Demko, especially if you're making it like a half. So it's like, okay, he's not going to play on Wednesday. He's probably not going to play on Friday. Does he come back sometime next week? Couple games to get back in. And then for the final, 15 games of the year. You get 10 games of peak Demko out of him or something. Like, would that qualify as a half for you? Probably.
Yeah, I think that qualifies. If you get like 925 sure. Demko, sure. Yeah. That would be, look, at the end of the day, if you're saying you'd rather bet on Demko's durability at this point than Pettersson finding his game, I think that's really what you're trying to say.
And that. Oh, man, when you put it like that.
Well, that's what you were saying.
No, it's true.
I was just translating.
You're right.
I'm not saying it. You are.
Do you disagree?
I'm not getting mad about things that haven't happened yet. No getting pre-mad this week.
But I'm not getting pre-mad. I'm getting mad at the last 13 months.
Look, it's tough. It's tough. That road trip was really tough.
It's, man, I feel like I could just...
Yeah,
go on this insane rant about it, but I'm not going to. I'm gonna stop myself. I'm sure there will be another time and place for that at some point. We will take a break here in just a second. By the way, once again, trade deadline coverage here on Sportsnet 650 is brought to you by AJ's Pizza on East Broadway. For diehard pizza people, order online at AJ's.pizza. And as a reminder, on trade deadline day here on Friday coming up, Halford and Brough will be going an extra hour until 10. Then we'll take over. We'll be on the air from 10 to 1. I think Bit comes on with the People Show after that, leading in to Canucks Central. And of course, it is a Canucks game day. So it's going to be, I think, legitimately from 6 a.m. till 11:30 of uninterrupted Canucks coverage, dedicated Canucks coverage here on the station, which is pretty wild. But that's coming up on Friday. We'll take a break. Open segment. Send your text in 650-650 to the Dunbar Lumber text line. That's next on Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650. Talk here on Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd, Thomas Drantz. We're live from the Kintech studio. 650, 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Metro Vancouver's trusted choice for contractors and rental warriors for over 50 years. Visit them at one of their three locations to serve you or online at dunbarlumber.com. It feels very much to me today like kind of the calm before the storm here going into trade deadline week. Obviously, a lot of speculation, a lot of anger, a lot of angst, as Austin and Langley would say, about the team's performance over the 5-game road trip. And we'll see how it plays out. Now, obviously, mostly focused on who's in, who's out, right? What do they do with the deadline? Do they keep Besser? Do they trade him? Who else do they trade? Do they spend to bring in people? There's always going to be a lot of focus on that. But I think one thing I'm very interested to see, and this text came in from Tim earlier, And you were talking about the lack of effort we've seen so consistently from this team. Tim says the most frustrating part of this season is the lack of effort. You can lose, but having to watch them lose while playing passively and looking disengaged makes me wonder why I'm paying to see this. I'm very curious to see the atmosphere on Wednesday at Rogers Arena when they take on the Anaheim Ducks. Because, man, they haven't been home. They haven't played a home game for a while. Obviously, with the Four Nations break and then the road trip right out of it. Now, last one, it was, I guess, that win against the Leafs. Oh, that feels like forever ago now. A lot of positivity after that win against the Leafs. But considering everything that's transpired since then, and just how high the level of frustration is, and I don't want to say apathy, because I do think it's still frustration, but the number of texts we're getting about, man, I can't believe I'm still investing my time in this. I like, why am I even doing this? All of those texts. We're getting a lot of those in. I'm very curious to see what the fan reaction is on Wednesday. And I also got to say, you know, I heard Rick Dhaliwal on Donnie and Dolly earlier today say, like, well, you know, if you sell Brock Besser and Pew Suter, like, you're waving the white flag. Good luck keeping the fans engaged for the final 20 games of the year. That risk is here. Like, fans are already really, really ticked off with this team. Really ticked off with this team. And in fact, far from being scared of losing the fans even more so if you make some seller moves at the deadline, I think the fact that this team has alienated fans to a significant degree, and I'm not saying it's every fan, obviously, but trust me, we see the text. It is a lot of people texting in along those lines. Like, the fact that your fan base has become so kind of frustrated and fed up with what they're getting on a night-to-night basis from this team, that shouldn't be like, oh man, therefore we're scared of selling. That's the opposite. That's another signal pointing in the direction of, can we really afford to invest in this team? Can we really afford to risk the opportunity cost of not selling some of these key guys? Like, it's all tied together. The lack of effort and the fan frustration, the fan anger. Again, like, that's not a, well, you better buy to satisfy the fans. That's a, you should trust the message the fans are telling you, which is that they don't believe in this version of this team.
Well, especially because of the rug pull nature.
Yes.
Of sort of what we've gone through again this season, right? I mean, every moment of sort of optimism has proven false for this franchise across much of this decade to this point, right? This decade opened with the bubble run. Right. And then last in the All-Canadian division, you had the Bruce There It Is run, evaporated pretty quickly. And then last year you had this miracle season that felt honestly more durable. Right. And I, you know, I didn't expect to be sitting here in the first week of March being like pretty confident that this team's in tough to make the playoffs.
No. And especially not. I think the biggest thing is, how much did we talk about last year about the vibes and the identity?
Right.
Where even if you could debate what the ultimate ceiling of the team was, it's like, hey, at least they found a defensive identity and a work ethic.
Right.
And to have that disappear, not just like, oh man, it turns out they didn't have enough offensive firepower to hang with the true contenders. Like, that's an outcome no one would have been shocked by. But to have that paired with the collapse of the work ethic, the collapse of the night-to-night effort, the collapse of the defensive identity, I think that's got to be the most galling thing for fans. It's just so completely shocking.
It is shocking, yeah. It's wild that they've ended up in this position, without question. And what would you say this team's identity is now?
Quinn Hughes?
Yeah, this team is...
has Quinn Hughes. That's the identity.
Yeah, this team is Quinn Hughes goes human joystick mode and...
Yeah. What else is it? There's nothing else you can hang your hat on.
Like, there's not. There's not even like, you know, you could describe it. And this, by the way, is one of the reasons why I'm also still interested in what Rutherford and Alvin and Tockett, that axis, right? And Tockett has the team option. So we'll sort of see how this all shakes out, but... You know, I'm hopeful that we get more of it, because what I liked about last year's team, as much as some of the offensive stuff was smoke and mirrors, and mm-hmm. and I didn't believe in it fully, you know, I thought the way that team played and built itself, right? Demonstrated this like cooperation between management and coach that was like, okay, we're a little bit slow on the back end, but we're going to have really big defenders. We're going to bring in a lot of speed in terms of our depth forwards. Mm-hmm. And we're going to protect and insulate the lack of speed on the back end by dominating possession and getting everyone to buy into this really conservative puck management approach. Yeah, we'll be a little reliant on point shots, but we're going to be able to give up absolutely nothing off the rush, and we have enough one-shot scorers to pull it off and sort of outkick our coverage in terms of what we're actually generating. And in addition to that, when we do lose possession, we've got this neutral zone wedge. We're going to have fast forwards back checking with an intense level of discipline. Mm-hmm. And then we've got these, and we're effectively herding puck carriers into massive bodies surfing the blue line and squeezing them at the defensive blue line. So we're going to be really hard to gain possession against. And then when teams are set up against us, we're going to have a massive 6'5" guys just cross-checking you every second. And good luck. Have fun. Like, good luck. Have fun. By the way, we also have Demko.
Yeah.
LOL. That made a lot of sense. And in addition to being smart tactically, Tocchet was able to get the mentality, because that's such a key part of this. You can have the most well-thought-out, well-constructed blue line. If you don't play with a mentality, which is really what we mean when we're talking about identity.
Yeah,
sure. A mentality in terms of how it should look and feel when you play. You're dead in the water. That's high-level stuff. That's like combining player acquisition and scouting with tactics and systems know-how.
And coaching.
And coaching, yeah. And I love that. Now, it's so clear that this team went into this year. First of all, they were always set up to have something of a one-year window because of some of the choices that they made, including like Hronek mm-hmm. needing an extension and the logic of Pettersson's timeline, right? The fact that he needed a new contract. Just the way that it was, we all knew about how all in they were on last season. It worked out. Management got their extensions. Team made the playoffs. They got Pettersson extended, which seemed good at the time. But it was always going to be difficult to pivot because, you know, Hronek and Pettersson alone last year combined for $11 million, and this year they combined for what, 19?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's a huge gap. It's a huge difference. The fact that the team came in being roughly as good on paper was something of a triumph, I thought, in the summer when I was talking about the moves that this team made. I didn't think they'd taken a step back, and I expected them to need to. So I thought that was pretty good work. Ultimately, a lot of the bets didn't pay off. And this team's attempt to add speed and offensive dynamism on the wings at the expense of their center depth, which ultimately was the right call. I mean, the Lindholm contract's a disaster.
Yes.
And we knew it was going to be if the Canucks did it. They still tried. But the fact that that didn't work out, Sprong didn't work out, Heinen didn't work out, right? Sherwood's been good. DeBrusk's been good. And then the defensive gambles didn't work out at all, right? Like on the back end, it just felt so ill-fitting. And so this team's effort to build on that mentality that they forged, that tactical high work rate, high discipline mentality that they forged last year, kind of faded. And worse than that, imploded as a result of sort of behind the scenes dysfunction, which really waylaid this entire season. Injuries played a huge role in this too. Dakota Joshua, Miller, mm-hmm. Miller's absence Hronek, for 10 games,
Hronek
for
now.
6 weeks. Yeah. Well, Hughes and Pettersson right before Christmas, yeah. Right? I think, I mean, you charted the December 12th. It's like Pettersson had that 2-goal performance against San Jose, then leaves hurt.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's probably something there. I don't know how much. I don't think it's just that.
Who knows?
Yeah, who knows? Black box. Demko obviously is a big factor there too. So there's been some injury context that have sort of combined to make this a nightmare season. But at this point, the step back is baked in. You know, I think this has a real shot to be one of the most disappointing seasons in the history of the franchise, given the preseason expectations coming in. And so I think for fans, it's just like, again?
Yeah.
You know, it's so easy to put this as like the third time in this core's existence that the team has appeared to take a step forward and then massively let down anyone that believed in them the next year.
And I think the tough thing is not to bring it back to Elias Pettersson. but so much of it does revolve around Elias Pettersson. Unless you still are holding out hope that he will be next year first line center Elias Pettersson, it's very hard to have optimism going into the future, right? So it's not just the negativity isn't just limited to this year. It's also looking ahead to the future. And I actually think, despite how disastrous this season has been, if you did think with any degree of confidence, hey, we're getting first line center Elias Pettersson back next year, I think there would be reasons to be optimistic and reasons to be interested about, okay, hey, they've got some cap space and get some assets for moving Besser. You've rebuilt the blue line. Hedl's interesting. You know, add some more speed. You've got Volander and Lekkerimäki coming from. Like, okay, it's not like a home run or anything, but there's some reasons to get on board and be interested with that. The problem is, if it's not paired with Elias Pettersson being a first-line center caliber player, a clear-cut first-line center caliber player, how relevant is it? And so I think that's the problem we run into here, is it doesn't just feel like, man, this season that fans were really excited about has ended up being a wash, has ended up kind of being a massive disappointment. It becomes really, really difficult to see the path forward if you're out on Elias Pettersson, and so many fans are completely out on Elias Pettersson, given what we've seen for 13 months now, going back to the All-Star break last season. So that's kind of the tricky thing here, is there's individual things that I can map out to be excited about. And hey, I'm curious to see how they use this cap space and all of those things, but it all just feels kind of irrelevant as long as Elias Pettersson is given these types of performances. And as long as you have no idea what's going on and no reason to expect it to get better, it's like, okay, yeah, Tom Volander could come in and be really good. Is it going to matter, though? And that's a tough place to be.
Yeah, it is. It's a very tough place to be. And I think the standoffish way that Pettersson has dealt with this season, I think, has exacerbated these questions, right? There's not a story that's out there that people can grapple onto,
mm-hmm.
right? I think that's why the Ian McIntyre, exchange mm-hmm. caught fire, right? Is that there's this mystery, and the idea of even asking about it is like crossing the line.
Yeah.
Like, pretty hard to root for someone if you don't understand what they're going through, especially when they struggle. Like, it's pretty hard to have someone's back as a fan if you don't have a response to the Oilers fan that's like, LOL, you think you're ever going to beat us with Elias Pettersson?
Yeah, you can't. There's nothing to latch onto.
There's nothing to say.
No.
And so I think that's, been problematic too.
Yeah, it's been deeply problematic, to say the least, this year. And then
probably doesn't help to have his celebrity friends out there yelling fake news either.
No, probably not. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. And this one comes in, unsigned, I believe, who says, as we talk about the possibility of adding guys who are long-term fits to the roster at the deadline. Sorry if I missed this already. What do you think the value is on Josh Norris in Ottawa, regardless of whether it's a good idea? I think it'd be a great idea.
It's a great idea.
I think it'd be a home run idea.
Wins draws.
Yeah.
Quinn Hughes' college
big
roommate.
Body, scores goals. Like, let's go. I just have never understood the logic from Ottawa's point of view. I guess there was a report out there earlier in the year that maybe they're worried about his injury history and they would consider doing it.
Yeah, I mean, it's a big liability and on, but I mean, you're talking about a guy who can contribute on the power play, who Travis Green, one of the most demanding defensive coaches in hockey, is thrown into brutally difficult minutes.
Mm-hmm.
He wins faceoffs, he plays big minutes, he's skilled. Yeah, I mean, look, and by the way, I know that the Canucks like this player. So, yeah, I mean, I'm into it. It's just like, I don't know. I mean, how much are you surrendering to the Ottawa Senators to pull this off? Because, again, Green's usage speaks volumes to me. It tells me that they're not out by any means.
Yeah.
Like, this is a guy that they have made core to their defensive identity, and they're one of the best defensive teams in hockey. So why are they trading him?
That's the thing.
I just don't see it.
Yeah. If he's available, then yes, like, that's the exact profile of a guy that the Canucks should be looking for, right? He's 25 right now, six foot two.
Lower your sights.
No, sure. But like, 6 foot two, his history of producing, signed long term, all of those things. Quinn Hughes' college roommate. That's right.
Signed long term and is Quinn Hughes' college roommate. Sounds great.
It's actually almost too perfect for Project Convince Quinn Hughes to stay.
Hey, buddy, acquired
you remember
your
this guy?
College roommate.
Remember how you guys used to hang out in the quad together? We got him. He's back.
You making a big decision about your future? Here, we've got your college roommate.
Signed until 2030.
Very strong.
That's a strong
play. It's a strong pitch.
That's a very strong play.
So, yeah, I mean, should the Canucks pay a premium for Josh Norris? Yes!
Yes.
Obviously.
That would be good.
What are we talking about?
A good thing for them to do.
Go Wolverines.
If, for some reason. Well, we need Tom Brady to take a minority ownership stake here. Get the Wolverine connection going.
Hey, if you start
doing the tampering, and where was it? It was like the ski resort he was talking to Matthew Stafford.
The Montana, yeah, at the Tetons. And I mean, if you paid attention to Deadspin and Discoveries from a decade ago, you'll know that might not be outside the realm of possibility for the Canucks.
There you go. Yeah, that's so funny about his college roommate. Yeah, it makes it a perfect fit no matter what.
Yeah.
Just go get it done.
Do you think Josh Norris makes sense? No one makes more sense.
There's not a single player in the league who makes more sense.
The problem is there's water under the bridge. If you're talking about Pettersson being in that deal, there's water under the bridge.
With Travis Green, yeah.
Like I would say of the teams least likely to consider that.
Yes.
I'd put the Ottawa Senators pretty high up the list. Now you'd overrule your coach if you thought it was a completely unique opportunity. But, you know, you're also gambling at this point on, like, player who's struggled for mystifying reasons across the past 12 months, who's struggled handling a Canadian market, and who's had open problems with a player in the locker room. So if you're acquiring this player, you know, at this point, you are doing so off of this idea that, like, you can get more out of him than another organization, and you're probably leaning pretty heavily on, like, character assessments from people you trust. Well, you're going to trust your head coach, and I don't know this, but I doubt that Travis Green would have a glowing assessment of sort of how, you know, things played out with Pettersson over the sort of latter stages of his coaching tenure in Vancouver.
Do you, and this is a big side joke to bring up with only a few minutes left in the show, but it wasn't that long ago, of course, right before JT Miller was traded, that we heard reports that Carolina still had a very attractive offer.
Did you see this text referring to Josh Norris as the Quinsurance policy?
Yes, that's right.
Let's go.
But we know, you know, relatively recently, Carolina had a pretty attractive offer on the table for Elias Pettersson. But since then, Pettersson's play has really hit a new low, and he was also in the spotlight for struggling at the Four Nations. Do you get the sense that the market of teams who would be interested, and certainly the market of teams would be interested in not just, like, doing it or taking him off your hands, but paying real value for Elias Pettersson? Is it starting to shorten here now as, you know, post Four Nations and as his play continues to deteriorate?
Sorry, the Pettersson thing?
Yeah.
What about it?
Like, is
he getting dealt?
No. Are we out of the, 30 teams would be lining up to get him stage here? You know what I mean?
I still think there's a lot of teams that would be lining up to buy low. And I still think there's teams that would still part with significant assets. But I think the win now teams probably, like, I think it's sort of an interesting dynamic. Like, Carolina was the data point that mattered to us, mm-hmm. right? They made a big offer, a big package offer for Pettersson, and then decided instead to go the Mikko Rantanen direction. Now, they've been having issues getting Mikko Rantanen signed. If that dynamic is still in place at the draft, could they revisit it, right? Well, maybe, but I think from the perspective of a win-now team, at this point, given Pettersson's form, it would be more like an off-season
play. Well, the deadline doesn't make any sense.
No.
You know, if a deadline doesn't make any sense.
I don't think you're looking, unless you're a team like Buffalo and you want to get him in now.
Sure.
So that you can familiar, but I mean, are they really going to have the same, like, Lindy Ruff's going to get another kick? Who knows? Like, who knows what's going on there? So I think if you're a team that wanted to, like, get rolling with him so that he came in familiar, right? Make him as comfortable as possible, maybe. But I think it's more of a beyond this season play. And I still think there would be teams interested. I just, you know. He needs to play a lot better than this.
The understatement of the century.
Yeah, I don't even know what we're watching anymore.
This is why, like, I don't buy the Huberto stuff or anything. You know what I mean?
No, no,
it's
no.
Like, I don't think it ever looked like this for Huberto.
Well, so I know we're running out of time.
Yeah.
But a couple guys stand out to me. Like, the best comp that I can think of and find is Brad Richards, I think. Where, you know, comes into the NHL and has a 60 points is second in Calder, 62 points in his first year, 62 points at 21, 74 points at 22, 79 points at, at 79, 91 points at 25, 70 points.
Yeah.
At 26, he's a Selke nominee. He finished runner up for the Selke one of those years. No, he didn't. But he finished, he was getting Selke votes. He wins the Stanley Cup in there. And then at 27, 62 points.
But even that's going to be like, Pettersson's going to have like 45.
And at 28, 48 points.
And then how many games? 48 and
56.
That's what I mean.
You're right. And then is back to being like a 91 point guy at 29. But I think more than anything, like Brad Richards, there was this moment where he was talked about as being like better than LeCavalier or better than St. Louis.
Yes.
And then the fact that he dipped in his mid 20s sort of sealed that he was more like a good first line, not a Hall of Fame level player.
Yeah.
And I think the fairest way to look at what's happened to Pettersson here, because Giroux sort of had one of these dips too in his late 20s,
mm-hmm.
is that he's more likely to be like a first line player, more likely to be on that Stasny track than on the track of some of the other comparables that he's kept for most of his career. I think that's the fairest way for us to look at it. That's still a player most teams should want to acquire.
All right, we'll end it there. We will be back tomorrow to continue to look ahead to the trade deadline. Canucks will practice tomorrow as well, so we'll have reaction out of that. That's tomorrow here on Canucks Talk, Sportsnet 650.